In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void. And darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light.
So tonight, what are we going to look at? We're going to look at how old is the earth. We kind of looked at the concept of how old the universe is. And we know that the three major evidences for the older universe are the abundance of light elements in the universe, helium and hydrogen primarily. Those are your light elements. The fact that the universe is expanding. And then the other one is the cosmic background radiation, which is probably the most difficult thing to answer from a young universe creationist, the cosmic background radiation. Quite frankly, there is no good answer yet. You know, you can question about the implications of it and what does it mean, but the fact that cosmic background radiation exists, that's not debatable. Again, it's kind of like saying, well, is the sun real or is the moon real? Of course they are. That's what you'd be debating. But it doesn't mean that that proves an old universe, and I don't want to imply that. It's just that that's one that really hadn't been worked out as well as the others. Even the light elements in the expansion, there could be other reasons for that besides an old universe, but they're there. And then we looked at the light travel problem. So we've looked at that. So now I want to turn our attention more to the Earth. But before I do that, and how old the Earth appears, how are there evidences for an old Earth? Are there evidences for a young Earth? And we're going to look at that in some detail. But I wanted to look at a few other things that show that the universe may be a young universe. We've shown the kind of the data that implies it might be older, but are there some things that don't quite jive? And now the commonality of all these evidences we're going to show real quickly here in a minute is they tend to show a much younger universe, or at least they are enigmas or paradoxes or puzzles that the old Earth people can't, or the old universe people can't really answer. They don't prove a young universe. Some of them say the universe can be no older than, let's say, 44 million years. Well, if you're a young universe creationist, that's still pretty old, but it's a far cry from the 15, 13.7, 14 billion years, however old the universe is supposed to be. It's a far cry from that, and so that's what we're going to be looking at, like I said, briefly tonight. So we're going to go back just a little bit here. So there are evidences or contradictions or enigmas that seem to point to a younger universe. Now, some of this is technical, and I want to go into a lot of detail. If you have more questions, we can talk about it after class or some other time. But we're going to, by necessity to cover this stuff, go pretty quickly. But one of the examples or one of the problems that we have, and some of this comes from Danny Faulkner, who's an astronomist, a creationist, but an astronomist. Some of this comes from Dr. Hodges, who is also a PhD, and I've looked at his book a lot. He's got a very good book called Evolution versus Creation. But this came from Danny Faulkner. So he looked at the Earth-Moon system. What's the problem? George Darwin, of all people, the son of Charles, discovered years ago that the moon was slowly receding from the Earth. So as we sit here, the Earth is moving further and further away. The moon is moving further and further and further away from the Earth. Now, it's not going very fast, obviously, and it isn't going fast enough for that to make any difference in our lifetimes, or our sons and daughters, or grandsons and granddaughters' lifetimes, or many, many thousands of years from now. But it has serious implications. It's moving at a rate of 4 centimeters a year. You know, that's almost imperceptible when you consider that an inch is 2.5 centimeters thereabouts. So it's a small movement, and it seems to be speeding up how fast it's receding. So it's moving, and that seems to be going a little faster. And of course, it's only 0.0016 seconds per century, but this accumulates over time. This is a very slow movement. So if we fix the modern rate of recession and extrapolate it to the past, you can calculate how close the moon was to the Earth in the past, couldn't you? Just do the math. That's all you got to do. Now, does anyone remember how old the Earth is supposed to be in our solar system? 4.5 billion years, right? So you do the extrapolation, that means the moon would have basically been in contact with the Earth 1.3 billion years ago. It would have been in contact or maybe a part of the Earth, because we mentioned this earlier, that it was felt that the moon may have come from the Earth to begin with. Well, does that seem like a problem if it was in contact just 1.3 billion years ago? Not 4.5, not 3, not 2, but 1.3. That'd be a pretty short time in the evolutionary scale if you were looking at it from an evolutionary point of view. And so what would have happened then, for life to begin, the moon would have had to have gotten further away, and over a period of time, you can extrapolate out how far it would have been, let's say a billion years from now, and if at about the time life may have begun on the Earth, according to the evolutionist, the moon was that close, it would have produced these massive, massive tides that would have basically precluded life from beginning. So this Earth-Moon system doesn't make sense. Now, do the astronomers realize this? Yes, they do, but they have to come up with theories. It's funny. Uniformitarianism says what? We're going to look at that in a minute, or if not tonight, two, 3 weeks from now. But it says that things have been going kind of like how they're going now for billions of years. But they can't use that with this logic. It doesn't work. So they have to postulate some, Danny Faulkner calls it, some big event for that to occur. Now, again, this does not prove a young Earth, because once again, we said 1.3 billion years ago, the moon would have been in contact with the Earth. Of course, we don't believe the moon was ever in contact with the Earth. I mean, the Bible says the moon was created, right? And that's what I believe. But I'm just saying, if you take their theory, and I don't believe, and I think this makes more sense. If it was created, it could have been created a certain distance from the Earth to begin with. And you wouldn't need billions of years for it to get away from the Earth, right? So you wouldn't need this. And I don't believe that the Earth was ever in contact, excuse me, with the moon. But it still doesn't prove a young Earth, but it certainly does not disallow for it either. And then again, studies by evolutionists themselves have proven that the tides from the moon, as far as we know, has always been pretty much what they are. They've been steady. And if the moon's been receding from the Earth, that doesn't make sense. How about then, and Faulkner says that they have to invent something to explain it, and I think that's true. How about the sun? The sun provides some evidence for a younger solar system as well. Theoretically, the sun has enough nuclear power to burn for 10 billion years, which, you know, our solar system is supposed to be, you know, the Earth's supposed to be 4.5 billion years, and I guess the sun was built about at the same time. So it has enough power to burn for 10 billion years. And if it is 4.5 billion years old, like our system, then it must have slowly altered its core, thus increasing the nuclear fusion rate, brightening the sun. Remember where the power of the sun comes from. It's nuclear fusion. Hydrogen becoming helium, basically. One atom molecule becoming a two atom molecule, right? That's fusion. If I'm saying that right, but that's what happens. That's where we believe the energy from the sun comes from. For that to have happened and for it to be only 4.5 billion years old, we can actually measure how bright the sun is. And we can do calculations on how much nuclear fusion has to be going on to produce it. So calculations indicate that the sun should be 40% brighter today than when it was formed, and also 30% brighter than when life was supposedly to have arrived on the Earth 3.5 billion years ago. Would that create a problem? If the sun was 40% brighter now than it was, would that have created a problem? Well, what would you have had? A very cold Earth that would have been would not have been compatible with life. So the Earth would have to be much younger. Or it would have started out at severely low temperatures. It's things that are incompatible, at least for a complex life. You might have gotten some of these thermophiles out of it if you're an evolutionist, but you can't get complex life out of it. So naturalists assume the Earth had some sort of bigger greenhouse effect than it has now. You know what the greenhouse effect is? All the carbon that's out there and all the heat, what we're worried about today is what? The Earth getting too hot. That's what we're worried about. Well, if you had a better or more of a greenhouse effect billions of years ago, that would have allowed the Earth to be warmer, even though the brightness of the sun was less, correct? But there's no proving that. There's absolutely no proof in that, but that's what you would have had to have had. And so that talks about the greenhouse effect, the carbon dioxide and other gases that are in their atmosphere. And so the naturalists say we had to have a bigger greenhouse effect. And what Faulkner says about that is how two completely unrelated processes could have just so coincidentally evolved in exactly compensating ways for billions of years is amazing. Comets. Comets pose a problem for naturalists as well. Everybody, y'all remember when Halley's Comet came through a few years ago? Of course, it won't come again in our lifetime, but it was kind of neat to see that. Comets are fragile, and they're lost to collisions with planets. We don't see a lot of comets. Comets are ejected by gravitational forces, and after a while, they just wear out. So they're a fragile thing that we see. They're real. We know comets are real. And so we can estimate the upper limit of the time comets orbit the Earth. We can make that estimate. Astronomers have done that. And according to Danny Faulkner, once again, comets should have vanished after a few tens of millions of years ago. That's a long time from a young creationist point of view. But it's not nearly enough for the old universe point of view, right? So what's the explanation for this? Why do we still see comets? And we do still see comets. I was alive, y'all were alive, most of you in the room, to see that. I don't remember when that was. Was that 84? I've done forgot. We have to look that up. But when Halley's Comet last was seen? So what's their explanation? Okay, here we go again. We got to have something hypothetical because there shouldn't, according to the calculations, there shouldn't be comets still around. So astronomers propose a hypothetical comet belt or comet belts with both short period and long period comets where they originate from. Two of these are the Kuiper belt and the Oort cloud. This is a hypothetical thing. They don't know this. They haven't discovered this. But they've got a hypothetical explanation for why we're still seeing comets. There was a comet also, I mentioned this in your paper, I think, that landed in on Jupiter. I mean, it crashed into Jupiter, and that was witnessed a few years ago as well. So the point is, the Oort cloud has never been detected, neither has the Kuiper belt either, and it probably will never be detected because, according to the astronomers, it's a hypothetical distance that's so far away from us, we'll probably never see it. That's a nice hypothetical thing to have, something you know you can never prove. But comets are another reason to suspect a much younger universe. I got a couple others that I didn't have time to put in here, but I want to just mention them real closely. These come from Hodges as well. There's the problem with the sun also is a paradox of missing neutrinos. Now, apparently, because of the nuclear fusion that's going on, neutrinos are bombarding our Earth right now, neutrinos. These are subatomic particles that are bombarding our Earth. The problem is we only see about a third of the neutrinos that is calculated we should be seeing if the sun is as old as it's supposed to be. There's no explanation for that at all. So by monitoring these, we are at about a third what we should be looking at the age of the Earth. And again, we're again assuming that the energy is coming from nuclear fusion. It could be explained if you use gravitational contraction as where the energy is coming from the sun, but that puts the sun too young. And so they ignore gravitational contraction. They have no explanation for why we have such few neutrinos. We also see that the sun is shrinking uniformly. 400,000 years ago, extrapolating back, once again, same thing, is the same thing going on now that's been going on for millions of years. Extrapolating back 400,000 years ago, the sun would have been about twice the size that it is now. 400,000. 400,000 years ago is nothing on an evolutionary scale. And you'll have the exact opposite effect that you had when we talked about how bright the sun is shining. 400,000 years ago, it would have been too hot for life to exist on Earth. These are just enigmas. They're puzzles. We don't have explanations for them. But they certainly don't prove, again, a young Earth or a young universe, but they don't disallow for it either. Dust on the moon, I found this was interesting. When they landed on the moon, what was that, 1969, Neil Armstrong, when he landed on the moon, they didn't know how much dust was on the moon. They expected it to be several feet deep. They just didn't know. Because extrapolating out once again, if the moon was, 1.5 or 1.7 billion years old, there should have been a lot of dust collecting on the moon. Should have been feet of dust In fact, some had even estimated that there might be as deep as 50 feet of dust. Now, they had landed other things on there and kind of dispelled a lot of that. But how much dust is on the earth? Not very much at all. It's about 5 inches. There's not a lot of dust on the earth. It's about 1/200th of the predicted value for how old the moon is supposed to be. I said earth, I meant moon. And so those are other, I've got some other evidences, but I don't think we're going to go into that. It kind of belabors the point a little bit, and I don't want to go into great detail with it. But there's a lot of enigmas, puzzles, that when you look at the universe, that look to be that we have a younger universe. It isn't all about an old universe. That's my point. So how about the earth? Does everything except a literal interpretation of Genesis point to very old earth? Well, that's what you're taught in school. Taught over and over again how old the earth is, right? And so does everything except a literal interpretation of Genesis point to a very old earth? Now, if that was all we had, that's all we had. But there's plenty of evidences that show otherwise, and that's what we're going to be spending some time looking at in this class. But how you view that evidence that's out there, it's going to depend to a lot of extent on one's viewpoint or one's point of view. So if you're a naturalist, you're not going to be able to throw enough evidence at them. It's still going, can't explain it, doesn't matter. It took a long time for that to develop. And creationists could have the same thought. You know, well, I know that the Bible says the earth was created in 6 days. That's what I believe. It depends on your point of view. Point is, there evidence for both? I think there's a lot more compelling evidence for a much younger earth within what we're led to believe. And again, that's what we're going to be looking at. A few years ago, we took a trip. I'd never gone to the Grand Canyon until just really relatively few years ago. I'd always wanted to. It always interested me. And we just never took that kind of vacation when I was a kid. But when you go to that Grand Canyon, we took a guided tour. How many have been to the Grand Canyon? Probably a lot of people in this class. Have you ever taken a guided tour of the Grand Canyon? Huh? No, that don't count. Because a guided tour is what I'm getting at. We took a guided tour, and of course we're with, I don't know, a dozen people or something, and we got this young man driving the truck around, and he seems to be a pretty bright guy. I'm not sure if he was studying geology or this was just a summer job, but he was repeating the mantra about how the Grand Canyon was formed, and we're listening to all that, and I'm not believing it, but I'm not about to step in and say, you know, you're full of baloney. I don't think that's true. I mean, it wouldn't have got me anywhere. Probably got me thrown off the bus is what it would have done. But, you know, look at the layers of the Grand Canyon. Look at all these sedimentation layers. One sedimentation layer stacked on top of each other, right? In fact, Hodges says that there's probably no place in the earth that you can see all these sedimentation layers in one place like the Grand Canyon. It's kind of very, very unique on that level. So you see, and you don't get a real good picture of that, but you kind of see these little ridges that make up sedimentary layers. And so it took millions of years, supposedly, to make every one of these layers, right? How about the canyon itself? What formed the Grand Canyon? What's your idea on what formed the Grand Canyon? What, if anybody took that tour, what did they say the Grand Canyon, how it was formed? Well, the Colorado River, right? The Colorado River, going through there, eroded all this. I mean, from a practical point of view, when you're looking at that Grand Canyon and you're looking down there at the Colorado River, it looks like a little ribbon, doesn't it? And that's supposed to have gorged out this great canyon. Well, in millions of years of time, anything's possible, right? So that's what they say. It was the Colorado River, through erosion, through its meandering through there, that gorged out this great big canyon. And so that's what we're told to believe. And so most people believe that. But there's other reasons for it, and we're going to look at those reasons in just a while. That's sort of an introduction to what we're going to be talking about. So if Genesis is true, and if the days of the creation are literal, then the earth cannot be billions of years old. Would you agree with me on that? How would we come up with that deduction? Well, primarily through genealogies, right? Because if you look at the genealogies in Genesis, I think chapters maybe 7 and 11, you look at those genealogies and they start with Adam, and you just extrapolate back, then if the earth was built or created in a literal 6 days, it cannot possibly be that old. Now, there may be some gaps in those genealogies. We understand that. So what you come up with is maybe 6,000 years to 10,000 years. So given man was created on the sixth day, In observing the genealogies in the book of Genesis, the earth cannot be more than 10,000 years, and some would say 6,000 years. It just cannot be. So the only way you get around this, and we've looked at these theories already, so I won't belabor this point either, but the only way that you can get around this and still believe the Bible, okay, you can just throw the Bible out and believe whatever you want, but if you hold to the Bible and you try to believe that the Bible is the inerrant word of God, then how can there be more than 10,000 years at most of Earth's existence? And again, the only way you can do this is to see that the days are non-literal and say they're non-literal days, and that these the word yom there, which really means a day, has to be interpreted figuratively. Now, figurative language is figurative language. But I've had people say, well, the word day always means 24-hour day. Does that mean it can't be used figuratively, though? Of course not. We read about Herod being called a fox. Well, was the word fox literally the word fox? Yes. But it was still used figuratively, wasn't it? So I've heard that argument, and I understand that argument, and it's not that I don't believe that they were 6 days. I do. But to me, that argument doesn't always hold up. And I see a lot of literature that's written about that, and it's written in detail. That doesn't deny, though, that those days, that the word day could still be used in a figurative way, in my opinion. That's my opinion. But that's how you, one way you get away from that, is the days are not literal. There's the gap theory, there's the progressive creationist theory, and there's a bunch of other theories, and there was the other guy's theory, Dr. Shalander's theory that we looked at. We're not going to do that. And so what's the other explanation? And that is that it's the relativistic time issue. And that's the perspective of God. These were literal 6 days, but from our perspective, they were eons of time. That's the only way you can get around it. To me, the syntax of the book of Genesis indicates the days were days as we view them today. And to me, it also potentially undermines God's authority to believe otherwise. Besides of all this, besides that I think it's scriptural, there is a lot of evidence as well. And so if you're trying to convey, this whole class is about evidences, isn't it? So we're going to show some evidences that indicate the earth seems to be much younger than billions of years, as we're told. Now, when you're looking at this, there's two points of view. There's uniformitarianism and catastrophism, and we've looked at that a little bit, but I want to relook at it just briefly. So cosmology can be roughly divided in two major categories. Either a uniformitarianist or you're a catastrophist. So what's the difference? Uniformitarianism abandoned the belief in the biblical flood, espousing the concept that natural processes through time proceed at rates seen today. And in your paper, I point out to Lyell back in the 1800s, who wrote the book that kind of changed men's thinking. He was a lawyer turned geologist, and he's the one that now has turned more towards this uniformitarian point of view. And their mantra is the present is the key to the past. So to answer your question, it's processes going on now, have been going on since basically started. Now, they wouldn't totally deny catastrophes occur. That'd be stupid. That's not it. But they want to say that the major things that we see, the major geologic changes, go to the Grand Canyon, for example. Go to the Grand Canyon. All those geologic processes primarily started over a period of time where erosion and wind and rain and all that for a slow process of time produced the geologic process that we see today. Why do they come up with that? Or how do they come up with that? Well, they measure what's going on today. They measure how long it takes a river to cause a certain amount of erosion. You know, go to any river and just measure it. They measure those sorts of things, and so they extrapolate it out, and if processes were going on at the rate they're going on now, then it would take X amount of time for that to occur. Look at stalactites and stalagmites. You can do the same kind of thing. How long does it take for those to occur? If processes going on right now are going on for eons before, it takes a while for those things to develop. Actually, we can find out that those can develop very quickly, by the way. It doesn't take a long time. But that's the concept of uniformitarianism. So through erosion and other events, we can look at the Earth, and that's where they get the radiometric dating, which we're going to look at, because the decay in the radioactive materials going on today was the same as it was 100 years ago, was the same as it was a million years ago. That's how they are, in some cases, a billion years. That's uniformitarianism. To me, though, again, this concept seems to ignore how catastrophic events have changed the Earth in the past, and for that matter, how they're changing them now on our planet. And we're going to look at a couple of those. We mentioned them briefly. The Apostle Paul predicted this about 2,000 years ago. The Apostle Peter in 2 Peter 3, 4 through 6. Let's just read that, because it looks very similar to what you see the uniformitarians are using today. Where's the promise of his coming? And Peter was talking about the second coming of Christ and people waiting for him to come, and he ain't here. Where is he? Where's the promise? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. Sounds like uniformitarianism to me. For this they willingly forget that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of water and in water. That means talking about the creation there. By which the world then that existed, being flooded with water, by which the world, water by which the world had then existed, perished, being flooded with water. They ignore that there was a flood. Now, they weren't around to see the flood. They should have known about it. They had the book of Genesis, didn't they? They should have known about it, but they ignore it because it ain't happened in their lifetime. So we tend to forget about things that don't happen in our lifetime. We've had some major catastrophes happen in our lifetime, though. But some of the big ones, we certainly weren't around for the flood, and the only one who survived the flood, weren't a lot of people left to talk about it, but obviously they should have known about it. So catastrophism holds that the world can be changed and molded by major cataclysmic events, and the most important one by far is the flood. And that's why we're going to spend at least one class looking at the flood specifically. Not just from the Genesis account of it, but what are their evidences that some major flood occurred throughout the world? Because if you're like me, you believe that the flood was a worldwide phenomenon, right? It wasn't just a local bad flood. And by the way, what's probably the most destructive things that occur in this earth? It's water. Water, very, very, very destructive. Look at the tsunami, that's just one example. So if people don't think water can do damage, it's probably the most destructive thing, probably more destructive than fire in a lot of cases. Earthquakes, floods, volcanoes, hurricanes, tornadoes, these are all catastrophic events. They have a profound change in how geologic features look. Canyons and valleys, believe it or not, can be created very rapidly. An example being the Colorado River. Again, let's use the uniformitarian's point of view and how fast erosion can occur. If you look at the erosion that is occurring in the Colorado River right now, you'll never get the Grand Canyon. There's not enough going on. So how could it be from that? It couldn't be from erosion from that river. Even their theory holds to that. It can't be from that. You can see canyons forming very quickly. We've seen canyons forming in our lifetime from the destructive processes of water. Now, have we seen a Grand Canyon formed in our lifetime? No, of course not. But we've seen those sort of things. That's just a picture of the meandering and winding of the Grand Canyon. I'm not sure if that's the North Rim or South Rim. We got a good close look at the South Rim, Cherry and I did, by taking a helicopter in it. It is amazing. So no catastrophic event ever witnessed by man, that are alive today at least, was witnessed by four men and four women, but not witnessed by men that are alive today, could compare with the flood of Genesis. Just think about it. We haven't seen anything like that. How long was Noah in that boat? 150 days? Had in the rain for 40 days, but we also know something else happened during the flood. Springs came up from the ground. We're going to talk about all that when we look at that. And I think it was more than just rain. The Bible says the heavens were opened. It was more than just what we might have had of last week. It was more than that. So was the flood local or was it global? I think it was global. John Morris. The more and more we find out about geology, the more and more he thinks it proves a young earth. You know who John Morris is? He's got a PhD in geologic engineering. He is a young earth creationist. He's written the book that we referred to a lot in this class. And he said, this is indeed a wonderful time to be a young earth creationist because so much information is now available that confirms our understanding of Scripture. So let's don't be afraid of geologic structures. They confirm a young earth more than they deny it. And guess what? Many geologists now are understanding that. There's a new move, apparently. I'm not a geologist, but apparently, according to Dr. Morris, there is a new move in geology, and it's looking more at the catastrophic point of view. They're referred to as neo-catastrophists, neo meaning new. So they understand that some of these formations, there's too much contradictions. Now, do they believe in a young earth? No. The majority of them still believe in an old earth. But they believe that these changes occur, and then there's lots of time in between each one of these changes. Why do they need that time? I don't know. You'd have to ask them. But I guess if you're an evolutionist, you still need that time. But they realize that these changes occur quickly. Dr. Derek Agar, president or former president of the British Geologist Association, the hurricane, the flood, or tsunami may do more in an hour or a day than the ordinary process of nature have achieved in 1,000 years. In other words, the history of any one part of the earth, like the life of a soldier, consists of long periods of boredom and short periods of terror. We used this analogy when we did OBGYN, didn't we, Toby? When you're having babies, what is it? There's a lot of waiting around, waiting for that baby to come. There's a lot of boredom going on. I remember women coming there having their dominoes and checkers. They're going to play those while they're going through labor, which they never did, by the way. But yeah, it's kind of like that. A lot of time, and then there's terror. Well, that's the way it is, according to Dr. Agar. Yeah, a lot of terror. That's why he sees catastrophism. So there's a lot of mundane things going on most of the time, but then you have these catastrophes, and they change the earth completely. So neo-catastrophists believe nearly all the rock materials of the earth were laid down rapidly as sediments by catastrophic events. Again, they would claim that much time would elapse between these events and these layers of sediment, but they have no proof whatsoever. Dr. Faulkner, I don't know if I have it on the slide, yes. He said the evidence for time is the lack of physical evidence. They don't have any evidence that there was a lot of time in between. And so their evidence is lack of, kind of goofy. So I believe we're going to stop here because this is going to go into a whole different topic. So when we pick up this topic, read your stuff next week. I will be adding a little bit more to that. But we're going to look at the evidence for a rapid deposition of geologic strata. And you're going to see strata-like occurs in the Grand Canyon does not take millions and millions and millions and millions. It takes a while, but it doesn't take that long, and how it's very compatible with a young Earth.